back in the day, when I worked at the store, Pay and Save Corporation, I had a certain boss who was always very well dressed. He always wore the best of clothes. Shirt was always pressed. His tie was always tied rightly. Unfortunately, as a manager, he was a very poor leader, and I had the unfortunate position to be under him in that respect, but nonetheless, he was just a poor leader. He would walk contradictory to what he would say. He had policy, for example, against swearing in the workplace, but he swore quite a bit. He had policies against fraternizing in the workplace, even as he was carrying on an affair. He would bend the rules, even though he would tell us not to bend the rules. He was a big and imposing man physically and very intimidating. Few people would dare challenge him. And you don't want to make him mad because he had an awful temper. But he dressed well and he looked the part. In other words, if you didn't know all these other things, and if you just saw him on the street or walked into the store and saw him walking down the aisles there, you would think, wow, there goes a good manager. I wonder how many Christians have such bosses. And then I wonder how many wives have such husbands. And then I wonder how many children have such fathers who on the surface look good, like they should be leaders. They should be counted. They should be given respect, and yet once you get to know them, it's quite a different story. The central problem to all of that, of course, is that we have men in leadership positions who think they're leading just because they do look good on the surface. Well, what about Christians themselves? I'm not accusing anyone, but I am admitting the obvious that looks can be deceiving and things are not always as they seem. Just because a husband drives his family to church, so to speak, does not make him a spiritual leader. He might not be anything more than a chauffeur in the most literal sense, if that's all that he does. Just because a wife obeys her husband or her children attend Bible classes doesn't make that husband or that father a godly leader. You can get the same results with godless men, or I should say in godless context there. Just because men are elders doesn't mean they're shepherding. Just because men are deacons doesn't mean they're serving. Just because men are preachers doesn't mean they're preaching the whole message or preaching it well. So leadership does not begin externally or outwardly, but rather it begins internally or inwardly. True leadership really is the product or the result of the internalization of God's word, not just knowing what it says, but internalizing it. In other words, becoming what it teaches, becoming where it leads you. Natural-born leaders do exist, I do believe that, but Christian leadership requires something more than just natural talent. I hope that makes sense. You can have talents or maybe some kind of leadership abilities that you're born with or seem to do well at, but that doesn't make you necessarily a godly leader by itself. There are basic principles of leadership that you can follow as a major corporation or as an individual person that can be modeled on the excellent leadership of Christ, and you'll do well if you follow them. But you have to internalize Christ in order to become like Him. So we want to ask ourselves this morning, how do we compare to Jesus' model of leadership? And again, it's not to beat us up, it's to admonish us, to encourage us, to remind us. Now, this lesson, too, is going to focus on men, but the principles of the lesson apply to all leaders, all mentors, all heads of household, regardless of gender. So, I'm going to be talking like I'm just talking to the men, but if you happen to be a woman this morning, don't think that you're excluded. We're simply talking about the principles and that men of all people ought to exemplify those. Well, the definition of a good leader is he knows the right way. He goes that way himself, and he inspires others to follow him. I'm going to cover those points in a little bit more specifically. I guess what you hear sometimes is, you know, what we're really looking for is someone who walks the walk and talks the talk. Although it's kind of a cliche expression, it's still very true. And that is really what we're talking about. A man ought to lead, not because he's told or because of peer pressure or because of guilt, but because he considers that a service to his God. He knows that he's responsible, and he also knows he's going to be held accountable for what he does. Leadership is a God-given responsibility. It is not an option. And there are men in all different seasons of life who have to lead in different ways in different phases of their lives. And at all times, we are leaders over someone. We are mentoring someone. We are providing a role model for someone. You may not even know who that person is, but you're still providing that role or that position there. Leadership is not just something you do. It's something that's really beyond you yourself. Granted, you're participating in it. You benefit from it, and so do others. But you have to understand that godly leadership doesn't just deal with the here and now. We're actually looking beyond the here and now into the hereafter. We're actually understanding that what we do here now affects the hereafter. And that's really important to see that. God has given us something that is the right thing to do and also has a, shall we say, transcendent purpose or a transcendent perspective to it. Christian leadership looks beyond this life into the life to come. So leadership is what we're saying here. Whether it's leadership of your own self, self-discipline, or of your marriage, or of your family, or even at work, ought to be considered a sacred responsibility. And because it is so important, and because it is sacred, you should be asking for help. You should be seeking the guidance of God. Jesus did all the time. Why do you think he was praying to his Father? Was he just communicating like, hey, we haven't talked for a while. How are you doing? Well, you really think it was that? Or do you think that Jesus was asking for help along the way, for strength, for direction, etc.? And if you think, if Jesus did that, being in the position that he was in, are you better than him? Do you need less guidance? Or do you need actually more than he needed? I think about myself. Am I better than Christ? I can't even compare to him in the least. But if he prayed to his God for whatever help and assistance, then how much more so should I be praying for that same thing? Am I more capable than him? Well, no. Well, then I should ask all the more for his help. Think about Solomon's request. We're not going to take, I was originally going to take time to do that, but just allow you to read that on your own. 1 Kings chapter 3, verse 5 through 14. I think you're familiar with the passage. That's where God comes to Solomon right after he's been appointed king over Israel. And God says, what do you want? Imagine the opportunity. God coming to you and saying, what would you like? And Solomon, thankfully, said, you've appointed me as a king over this people. And yet I'm a child. I don't know how to go in or come out. I don't even know how to handle this people. So give me knowledge and give me wisdom in guiding your people. And God was extremely pleased with that answer. And he said, not only am I going to give you what you asked for, I'm going to give you what you didn't ask for. And you can read the rest of the story there. But instead of selfish prayers like, God, I really wish I had a better car, a bigger house, a little bit more income, and maybe look better and be a little bit more muscular, you know, or something like that. Instead of those selfish kind of prayers, think about what we could be praying for, men especially. God, I am like a child. You've given me this family, or you've given me this responsibility. I don't know how to handle this except that you teach me and guide me. Won't God be very pleased with that answer? So I'm asking you, is that how you pray? Does that describe your prayer? We're told in Matthew chapter 7, verse 7, 8, ask and it shall be given to you, seek and you shall find, knock and the door shall be opened unto you. This is a means of gaining God's approval and his direction. It's not a suggestion. It's not a gimmick. It's not just something that we go through the mechanics of. It's something that we desperately need, and we desperately need to do. Anyone who wishes to be a leader for the sake of Christ must be prayerful, must be actively seeking His guidance. So if you're a husband or a father or simply a man who has people who look up to you, you're in a leadership capacity, and I'm asking you, are you asking God and seeking and knocking for opportunity? Or are you just kind of winging it? And you kind of meander through your day and your life, knowing you're supposed to be responsible and thinking perhaps that you are. But you're really not seeking the direction you're supposed to. One of the things God is looking for from you, too, is kind of a paradox here. One of the things that leaders have to be is servants. In the world system, leaders are often arrogant, celebrities, the rich and powerful, etc. That is completely backward from what God is looking at. And yet, as I said earlier, even the godless people who employ godly principles are usually successful because the principles transcend the greed and selfishness of man. So when those truly successful people do become servants, that seems to work. And the reason why it works is because it's a godly principle, as He's been telling us in Scripture. So, in Luke chapter 22, verse 24 through 26, in John chapter 13, verse 1 through 17, we have the occasion here of the disciples in the upper room with Jesus just before His arrest. They're having supper with Him. And what's interesting about that situation is everything is present there for foot washing. You've got the basin, you've got the water, you've got the towel. And if you read Luke's account in particular, what is it that they're all arguing about? Hey, who's going to be the first one to wash Jesus' feet? Oh no, that's not even in the discussion. The discussion surrounds which one of us disciples should be considered the greatest. Imagine that. You've got a basin of water, you've got the towel, you've got opportunity here to show yourself to be a leader by being a servant. And nobody picks up the clue. And then Jesus, you can almost hear Him sighing, goes over to the water basin, picks it up, brings it over, puts a towel on Him, and starts washing the disciples' feet. Can you imagine what they must have felt like? How humbled they must have become all of a sudden, realizing that that should have been them washing His feet rather than the other way around. And what He's doing there then is He's showing us that if you're going to be a leader in the way that God needs you to be a leader, then you must first become a servant. And if you're not willing to serve, but if you're wondering about who's the greatest among you, if that's your attitude, well, then you cannot become great in God's eyes. No one told Jesus to wash their feet. But He made an opportunity to show that God's leaders are servants. Because servitude is not something that just happens to you. It's something that you make happen. And then you read in John chapter 13, starting in verse 13, if you want to join me there. John 13, 13. Jesus says, "You call me teacher and Lord, and you are right, for so I am. If I then, the Lord and the teacher, wash your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I gave you an example that you also should do as I did to you." Think about the words here. And the example that He provided is something that we are to imitate. You say, "I got to wash people's feet." Well, if that's what it came to, yes. But the principle here is that you need to serve. He goes on to say, "Truly, truly, I say to you, a slave is not greater than his master, nor is one who is sent greater than the one who sent him. If, conditional, if you know these things, you are blessed if you do them." Double conditional. Which means, first of all, you have to know these things. And secondly, you have to do them. Notice that Jesus does not say, "Blessed are you if you know them, or just hear them preach to you, or if you study these things out in a Bible class." Well, that's part of it, but it has to go beyond that. The lesson has to leave the classroom and actually be demonstrated in real life, doesn't it? So now, let's get back to what I said about servant, or leaders rather, in their servitude. First of all, a leader has to know the right way to go. It has to not be a way, which is what's so popular out there. I have a way in which to go. And it can't just be his way in which to go, but it has to be the right way in which to go. And the only right way in which to go is God's way. And there is only one way. Pluralism, which is becoming increasingly popular in our world, in the religious world, means that there are many paths that lead to heaven. And if you want to choose Christ as your path, well, then so be it. Or if you want to choose some other form of enlightenment, then that works too, as long as you all end up on God's doorstep. That is not what the Bible teaches, and that's not what leadership is all about. If you look at John chapter 14, for example, if you're still in 13, just turn a page, you'll probably be there. John chapter 14, and starting in verse 4, Jesus says to his disciples, "You know the way where I am going." And Thomas says, "We don't know the way because you haven't told us." And then Jesus says, "Huh, didn't think about that." And then gets into a long discourse about the way. No. Jesus said to him, "I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father but through me." Think about that. Jesus knew where he was going. He knew how to get there. He had never any doubt about it, and he never took the wrong path himself. You know, you hear stories sometimes about people who get lost. They get into a bad part of town. I don't know a specific town I'm thinking of, but I've heard stories over the year. Sometimes it's Seattle, you know, or sometimes in the ghetto of any major city, really. And you find that they sometimes get robbed or they get mugged, sometimes even killed. You hear about people who go hiking and hunting, even though they're experienced hikers and experienced outdoorsmen. Even though that happens, they still sometimes get lost. I heard a couple years ago about two Israeli soldiers who were in their jeep and they got off course somewhere and kind of accidentally drove into Palestinian territory and they got shot and killed. My point here is, if you don't know the right way in which to go, it can be real trouble for you. But even more importantly for our lesson, you are completely unprepared to lead anyone else. I think that's one reason why James says in James 3 verse 1, "Let not many of you be teachers." Because not everyone knows the right way in which to go just because they think they're Christians. There's a lot of people out there who think they're Christians and they don't know the right way in which to go. In fact, if you had a preacher, imagine this. So you have a preacher getting up and he starts out, say, with a story about Moses and, you know, Israel, and he just keeps going. He kind of fumbles along, and he's kind of rambling, and pretty soon he says, "I'm not really sure where this is going." Someone in the audience ought to stand up and say, "Well, then, with all due respect, sir, please sit down." Because if he's not prepared to lead, then we shouldn't be listening to him. And if he doesn't know where he's going, then he's not prepared to lead. Not only that, but when we have this principle of error increasing over time and distance, anyone who's cut plywood wrongly knows exactly what I'm talking about, right? All you men with your skill saws, and you measured what you thought was a straight line, and it was just a little bit off when you started. And then when you got to the other end of the 8-foot sheet, you're way off. And the reason why that is because error increases over time and distance. And if that is true in cutting plywood or doing anything like that, it's also true, spiritually speaking, in your life. That is, if you get a little bit off course early on, then by the time you're 30 or 40 or have gone through your life a bit there, you're going to be way off course. Not just that little bit. You're not paralleling the path, so to speak. You're going way away from it. You cannot be a good leader if you're going in the wrong direction. Because not only are you off course already, but over time and distance, so to speak, you're going to be way off course. And the further you get from that narrow path that we talked about several weeks ago, the further off you get from the narrow path, the harder it is to come back. I'm not saying it's impossible, and I would never say don't try. You should, must try, but I'm just telling you it's going to be more difficult. And there's going to be a whole lot of damage that has been accrued along the way that now you're going to have to deal with. Once again, not trying to stymie anyone's opportunity. We want people to come to the Lord. But you've got to understand that if you had started out earlier and if you had stayed the course, it would have been so much easier for you. And that's true of anyone, not just you in your position, whoever you are, but it's true of anyone. They have to know the right way to go. Leaders must know where they're going, otherwise they have no business leading. And if they don't know, then we should not appoint them as leaders, and we should not recognize them as leaders. So think about that. Elders, for example, cannot just be eldering, whatever that means. They need to know the way in which a congregation needs to go, as well as their own lives. They need to know these things. The next goal, the next step, the next direction. Preachers can't just be preaching lessons. And I know preachers who do that, who on Saturday night pull lessons out of the file, dust them off, and offer them as if this was, you know, something they've been working on all week or the last several weeks. That is just not something to respect. Preachers need to be preaching the word. And they need to be preaching the whole message. And they need to put a whole lot of thought and time and effort into that preaching. That's their job. I don't mean their paid job. That's their job description, isn't it? Don't you expect that of them? Christian men need to know their role and their responsibility within the congregation, within the family, within the society. What is expected of me? How am I going to do that? And if you know how, then when are you going to do that, if indeed you haven't? Husbands need to know where their marriage is heading. Someone says, I'm married, what else is there to know? That's the problem. You think just being married was the goal, when the fact is, you should be drawing closer to Christ in your marriage. And husbands, you are the one who ought to take your wife's hand and lead her closer to Christ as well as yourself. Fathers need to know how to bring their children up in the instruction and discipline of the Lord. Train a child up in the way in which he should go, and he will not depart. That's a general axiom. I understand that. But it's still something that has to be done. And the father needs to know that way. He needs to have a clear objective in mind. Many parents just throw food and clothing at their children and go, there, I did my fatherly duty. Now I can go to work or hang out with the guys. And that's not parenting. And hopefully you know that. Jesus is the way, but knowing that is not the full story. You have to know what that means and then what that requires of you as well. Early Christianity, if you read Acts 9, verse 2, for example, early Christianity was actually called the way. And there's no reason why we can't still call it that, as long as we understand that there is the way and not a whole bunch of ways that are all legitimate. The way means it's superior to all other ways, and it has no equal. It also means that if your way is different from the way, then it not only leads you to ruin, it doesn't benefit you, but it's also the wrong way. But if you follow the way, not only is the way Christ, but it leads to where he is. It leads to the Father. It leads you heavenward. Interestingly, contemporary Christianity likes to label itself progressive and modern. Like, we are better. We are new and improved. We're not like old-time religion, you know. We are cutting edge. And yet, ironically, in order to accommodate that perspective, what you're seeing in the religious world is churches and church leaders seeking the LCD. Everyone knows what the LCD is, right? It's not the light bulb. It's the lowest common denominator. They're seeking the lowest common denominator. How can we dumb down this religion so much that so many people can jump on the wagon here? How can we dumb this down to the effect where we can get most or the majority of people to buy into it? Wow. That's cutting edge, that's progressive, that's modern, but that's not the way. Compare that with, say, Matthew 16, verse 24 and 25, where Jesus says, if anyone wishes to come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. And then in verse 25, he says, for whoever wishes to save his life, which is a way of saying save yourself, then he'll lose it. But whoever wishes to lose his life for my sake will find it. That is what's required. That is what Jesus says. Jesus isn't trying to bring everyone down to the lowest common denominator. What he's actually doing is bringing us up. And he's saying, I have high expectations for you, and I'm going to help you to achieve those expectations. I want you to come up in your thinking. So the second step, and remember, keep in mind that this is a maturity thing. First of all, you got to know a way in which to go. But secondly, as far as your maturity goes, you got to go that way yourself, don't you? Because you can't just stop at knowing something. And so you have to lead by example. No man is worth listening to. No husband is worth listening to. No father is truly worth listening to if he doesn't do what he tells everyone else to do. And that's what Paul talks about here in Romans chapter 2 in our scripture reading. I know it was kind of a heavy reading there, but the point he's making there in verse 17 through 24 is he's saying, you Jews in the church is really what he's talking about, okay? You Jews, you act like you're smarter than the Gentiles. You act like you know more, and you probably do, but not if you're guilty of doing the same things that you accuse others of. In other words, what's the old adage? You got to, as you see on the screen, practice what you preach. You've got to practice what you preach. You've got to walk the walk and you've got to talk the talk. Too many men seem to have no problem telling everyone else where to go, what to do, how to do things, but what of themselves? What about themselves? What about yourself? Do you have two standards? One for you and your loved ones, and another standard for everyone else? I've used this illustration before, like in driving. Like, do you have one standard for how you drive and another standard for how everyone else drives? In your standard, you know, when you make a mistake, it's like, oh, well, that was just a little bit of error. I just was busy, preoccupied, and so on. You're all forgiving and patient with yourself. But then when someone else does the exact same thing, you idiot, I can't believe you just did that. Ah, look at that. Look at that. Give licenses to people like that. Can you believe they're driving like that? A little bit of the New York thing coming out there. But my point here is that, sometimes we do have a little double standard, don't we? And people do as Christians as well. So I want you to think about this. This is a serious point here, that if you're kind of sitting back evaluating everyone else by your standard, but you're not doing it yourself, what kind of person are you? The Bible has a word for that. It's called a hypocrite. And that's where angels fear to tread. That's just not a place to go. And so some people, in hearing that, they're going to go the opposite extreme. They're going to say, well, since I'm not perfect, I dare not question anyone else's beliefs or anyone else's behavior. And you hear this a lot in the modern world because, you know, we have to all be politically correct and tolerant and, you know, embracing every kind of deviant, misguided, idiotic behavior that's out there because we don't want to offend anybody. And so we kind of say, well, yeah, there is a right way in which to go, but I'm not perfect, and how dare me to compare you to that pattern or that standard? It's like, if that's the position you're going to take, then you cannot be a leader. Because leaders have to know the right way in which to go, and they have to be going that way themselves. And whenever a leader does that, he is going to offend everyone who doesn't believe that and go that way. And you have to accept that. I'm not saying rub it in their face. I'm not saying be tactless and unmerciful. I'm simply saying you have got to accept the fact that people are going to disagree with you, and that's their problem. You have a job to do. You have a responsibility. Remember we said earlier, a sacred responsibility, a God-given responsibility, and you had better uphold that, even in the face of criticism. You're going to be offensive to those who do not submit to the way. If a man is unwilling to lead by example, what he's really saying is he doesn't believe in the way, or he's embarrassed by it. Think about that. Are you embarrassed about what you believe in? Are you ashamed to say it? Are you ashamed of the leader that you follow? Of course, then you can't even act like a Christian, much less a leader, if indeed that's what the case is. And I would encourage you, if that's you, to come to your senses while you can. Jesus always led by example. He never asked anyone to do what he would not do himself. And that's a principle for us men. In Matthew chapter 6, for example, you know, he said, pray in this way. And then he led a what we sometimes call a model prayer. In John chapter 13, verse 5 and following, as we just saw through the foot washing experience there, he taught humility and servitude. In essence, what he's saying is serve in this way. In John chapter 13, verse 34 and 35, he doesn't just say go and love like you guys want to love. He says love in this way. And he's shown them for the last 3 years. He had been showing them how to love. And he continues to show that. In Luke 23:34, he's on the cross. Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. That's not a wholesale blanket forgiveness like some people think, but it does demonstrate the attitude that God has about forgiving. He is a God who wants to forgive, and you should be. When people do fulfill the conditions of forgiveness, you should be a person who is ready and wanting to forgive them. Because Jesus led the way. So it is with us men or heads of household, especially leaders of families and congregations. If you want others to live like Jesus, well then you live like Jesus. If you want people to love like Jesus, well then you love like Jesus. And if you want people to serve like Jesus, well then just to tell them how to serve, you show by example, serve like Jesus yourself. And as you see on the screen here, husbands, if you want your wife to submit to you, if you want her to practice submission, well, then you had better practice submission to God. Submission, ideally, starts with the man, not with the woman. I'm not excusing women from being submissive if their husband is a louse. I'm simply saying here that submission, ideally, should begin with the husband. He should be submitting to God, and then the wife will want to submit to him if she is a good woman, right? If you want your children to respect and obey you, fathers, well, then you respect and obey God. Otherwise, you're a two-faced hypocrite, and they, your children, will know it. They may not say it. They may not even have the right word for it, but they'll know that Dad does things different than what he actually says. And that's not good, right? If you want your family to pray, then you pray. Lead in prayer. If you want your family to study, then you study. If you want your family to fellowship with Christians, well, then you had better fellowship with Christians, right? If you want your family to revere God, show that reverence toward God, then you show that reverence toward God. If you want them to sacrifice for what is right, for the sake of righteousness, then you sacrifice. If you want to forego those activities that Christians ought not to do, that is, if you want your family to do those, foregoing those things, then you need to forego those as well. You need to lead by example. Practice what you preach. Here's the thing. If you truly want your loved ones to join you in heaven, then you have to walk and talk and live and act like you're going there yourself. Don't you? Furthermore, in our progress of maturity, you have to know the right way in which to go. You have to go that way yourself, but you also need to inspire others to follow. What good is a leader if no one is following him, or if there's no one to lead, or if none is interested in following him? So inspire in this context here really means to encourage or to motivate or to cheer someone on or to rouse someone to duty. Provide a reason to act, in other words, as well as enhance their desire to act. Desire is not something that you can force feed anybody. It's internal. It's personal. But you can encourage people and nurture in desire and cultivate desire. For example, a father cannot force his child to serve God or to desire to serve God, but that father can and should encourage and nurture that desire. through his own enthusiasm, really through the benefits that he sees in that, and make positive arguments for that, and inspire with his own personal example, his own personal testimony. So that the child can say, my dad talks about following God, and he really does it himself. Wow, that's powerful. What an inspiration, right? And that's a good side. That's the positive side. This works both ways, sadly. On the negative side, you can also inspire your children to follow you in the wrong way. And this happens. What inspiration is there if a father will not engage in spiritual discussions? He will not teach his children about the Lord. He's not organized enough to attend a Bible study or perhaps even show up on Sunday. How inspiring is that? Actually, it is inspiring. It's just it's inspiring in the wrong direction. It's inspiring for the wrong thing. I'm going to make a statement here that is going to sound pointed, and I don't mean it to be. I'm just going to make a general observation here. We have some families that come late to services chronically. I don't mean just this morning or once in a while. I'm talking about chronically. I want you to think about the impact, you heads of household who I'm speaking to, and I don't really even know who you are because I don't pay attention. All I know is that when we start Bible class at 9:30, we have a smaller attendance than what we end up with. And I can't help but noticing that. And I want you to realize what impact, what lesson you're teaching your children when you do that. Chronically. Now, if the flat tire or someone's sick or the kid threw up on the way, I understand all that. Those things happen. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about you just didn't prepare. You didn't get up on time. You didn't make the effort. You just chose to come when you come. You can do that. It's a voluntary thing. You can choose to do that. But what I'm saying here, we're talking about leadership. What I'm saying is you are leading by example. Don't be surprised then when your children get old enough to come on their own that they also come when they want to and not when they should. Or maybe they won't come at all. You need to be setting the example. You need to be providing the pattern. Your children are looking up to you whether you realize it or not. Someone says, well, I don't have any children, so I'm off. Well, wait a minute. Other people have children. They might be looking up to you. Even though they're not your children, they're still looking up to you. You're setting an example. What kind of an example are you setting? You might be inspiring, that's true, but you might be giving the wrong kind of inspiration. I want you to just think about it. I'm just saying that because that's a real-life relevant application of exactly what we're talking about. Do with that what you will, okay? Understand, too, that Jesus did not just pop into existence for 3 days, give orders to 12 men, and assume their trust. Jesus led by example. Jesus lived and encouraged and developed these men's confidence for 3 years. He inspired them. He did not beg them. He did not demand them. He did not threaten them. He did not intimidate them to follow him. And neither should you, fathers or husbands, do those things. But what he did, though, is he nurtured and culled and roused their desire. He shared his own zeal. And oftentimes this is missing, unfortunately, among Christians today. We look out in the religious world and we see a lot of zeal without knowledge. And we go, huh, look at those people, bunch of zeal without knowledge people. Okay, well then maybe we're the people who are abounding in knowledge, but we don't have a whole lot of zeal. Which one is the accurate picture, or the one that God wants of us? Neither one is right. We should be abounding in knowledge, and we should be abounding in zeal. We should not be a people who is practicing zeal without knowledge, but neither should we be practicing knowledge without zeal. Don't you think? Inspiration does not come from mere discussions about it or mere devotionals. We need to have living demonstration, not just words. And that gets to a passage like Hebrews 10:24, where the writer says, let us consider how to stimulate one another to love and good deeds. Men, I want you to think about that. Not just tell other people how to love, and not just tell them that you need to do good deeds, but to stimulate them, to inspire them. The word actually in Greek there, the word stimulate, actually means to provoke in a positive way in this context. To provoke them. It can be used in the scripture in a negative way, like provoking, like when Paul was provoked to anger by all the idols in Athens. It's the same word. But here it's used in a positive sense. Let's stimulate one another. Let's provoke one another. Not to anger, but to love and good deeds. And the best way to provoke that kind of response is to lead by example, to do it yourself, and then ask others, come with me. Why don't you come with me? This is a good thing. I need you with me. We certainly have much more we could say on this, but my point here is you have to learn how to lead. You can't assume you already know or that you're doing fine. And even if you are doing fine, that's great, but you could still do better. You can still excel still more. You can't just look the part like my old boss did. You have to live the part internally as well as externally. Jesus was a model leader and a model teacher. He knew the way, he led by example, and he inspired others to follow him. I'm asking you, men in particular, are you striving to imitate him? I'm not just saying, you know, do you every now and then think about that? I'm asking, is that your endeavor, your earnest desire to follow him? I understand we're not perfect leaders. We're not saying that. But we can be perfecting our leadership by constantly modeling it after the master himself. So don't give the excuse, well, I'm not a perfect person. Well, of course you're not. If you were, you wouldn't have to be here. You just walk into heaven on your own merit. But here you are, an imperfect person, trying to do what's right, I hope. And that's what we're all trying to do. Let's model ourselves, I hope, after Christ. Furthermore, we, men, cannot expect women and children to function properly in their roles until we do ours. Right? I'm not saying that I'm exempting women and children from that. I'm just simply saying, ideally speaking, how can we go pointing fingers at them and saying, you guys need to get your act together, but we don't get ours together first? A provider is not someone who just throws food and clothing and a place to sleep at someone. As far as God's concerned, it is also a provider of spiritual instruction, spiritual guidance, and spiritual inspiration. God wants us to succeed, but before we can succeed, we have to know what's required of us. That's why I gave this lesson, so that we can know what's required of us, and we can make that application and do what's right. I hope this lesson has been helpful. I hope you've gained something from it. If you are ready to take on this responsibility of becoming a Christian, not having done that yet, this would be your opportunity to do that. Or if you've done that, but you haven't lived up to that, then you have an opportunity to repent, to come to God and start over. Isn't that a great thing? You can start over and recommit to the Lord this morning. If that's your desire, then do so as we stand and sing the song that Jeff has led. Come forward if you need to.